Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm Julia Stetter, your host, and today we'll be talking to Andreas Gerlach about his new book, Diebe, or in English, Thieves, Stealing in Literature, Philosophy, and Myth. Mr. Gerlach currently holds a postdoc position at the famous Humboldt University in Berlin. Mr. Gerlach, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, to start with, what is always interesting about an author, I think, is how he got the idea of writing his book, right? So I wonder whether you can just recall any key moment when you have started being interested in thieves, or can you just name some persons that have inspired you?
Well, I can actually, but it's always, I think, for if an author is honest, it's not just one moment that inspires a book, but it's more of a coming together of several influences and all that. So I could name several authors, of course, which would be Marcel Mauss in his work on The Gift, or Hans Blumenberg with his study of mythology that really did influence me. But I also have to name autobiographical moments that I think they were important studying the autobiographies in my book on stealing and theft. But, you know, I myself stole a Snickers once when I was a child, and that really stuck to my mind. And, you know, I didn't like it that much. Then it was just some candy bar, but it kind of stuck what happened to me there.
Yeah, interesting. to go on simple, I think everybody has got an explanation in mind what theft means, and even children, as you just mentioned. But nonetheless, could you just give us the most important characteristics of theft?
Yes, I can. It's actually not that difficult, because that initial notion of what theft is pretty clear already, and most people got the right definition in mind. But to define it more or less judicially, it's a theft is taking something without permission from the owner. And to make a, for me, vastly important differentiation, it is taking this thing without violence. And it would be robbery, taking it with violence, or with a threat of violence. And theft is always pretty silent, pretty cunning, pretty has to happen secretly and unseen in a way. And that is pretty much it. That's it, taking something secretly, or at least without threat to the owner.
So just important to keep in mind that theft and robbery isn't the same, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is something of pretty much importance. And I tend to get asked about people like Robin Hood or other famous robber barons or thieves of chiefs of robber bands. But that's not theft as such. That's pretty much stealing, with a tendency to be even more like a almost para society in the woods in the case of Robin Hood. That is something else. I'm interested in those tiny little actions of just taking something.
Oh, I see. Now your book looks at theft in a cross-cultural approach, yeah. So that it takes languages from different backgrounds into account. However, as we are here looking at your book from the perspective of German studies, we will mostly talk about the prominent German philosophers you include in your study. So, for example, in your first chapter, you mention Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Yeah. And as the reader gets to know, for Hegel's theory, property is quite important, because Hegel does not define the individual by being, but rather by having. So there's a difference between being and having. And but it sounds somehow a bit complicated. And so could you just explain what this means? And could you then clarify why Hegel's philosophy is crucial for your analysis of theft?
I can, or at least I can try. For This is a part of my book that really strict philosophers and Hegelians tend to not like all too much, because they, I went at it from a perspective of literary and cultural studies, and it's not as strict in terms as people would like to have it sometimes. But still, I do think that somewhere in the development of our culture, we move from a conception of the human being as being, and being a body, being a soul, being a subject to a ruler, being a peasant or lord, to a different approach. And Hegel is just pivotal to that change, I think. And we changed our conception of the human being from being to having, having a body, having a soul, having rights and having a job and having a vocation or something. And that switch from being to having happening sometime in, I don't know, after Renaissance or something, that is important in so far as when we define ourselves as having, we do have things as well. And those things belong to ourselves as an entity existing in this world. So when something is being taken from us, something is stolen from us, that directly affects us as human beings, and that directly reaches into the core of our existence. And as Hegel was very strong on defining the human being as through an act of appropriation and through having something, most of it ourselves, stealing becomes an act that tends to slip directly into robbery for Hegel, because that act directly reaches out to our core as such. We can't just be taken away something accidental. It always goes directly to a substance. So I think Hegel has very much understood that property is the utmost, the thing of the utmost importance for us in modern times. But still, he's very strict on theft and wants it to be punished pretty harshly, actually. He once says that for stealing a carrot, more or less, the death penalty is pretty much okay. So he got that notion that having is important, but and thus developed a very distinct feeling for when it's wrongly affected what one somebody owns and somebody else takes. But he's going strict on that, and that interested me a lot. Then that theft there is a crime of such importance, although he hardly ever talks about it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And as is well known, Hegel's philosophy had also a deciding influence upon Karl Marx.
Yeah.
And therefore, it is probably not so surprising that you do in fact mention Karl Marx later on in your book. And maybe you could just tell us what Marx says about the stealing of wood.
Yeah. That is a... Karl Marx has written a lot, that's for sure. But he started his writing as a pretty young person at the age of, I don't know, 21 or something, and doing journalistic work. And there he was sent to write for a newspaper. He was sent writing for a newspaper. He was sent to a pretty small and boring German regional parliament, where a new law concerning the collecting of wood in the forests was discussed. And that just first sounds very, very boring, as it maybe even was, but that completely enraged the young Karl Marx, because something of extreme importance and one could say a cultural shift was happening there, or was could be watched happening there, and that was the following. People in the German countryside were usually allowed to collect their firewood in the forests. And they needed that firewood for heating in winter and for baking their bread. That was a very, very important resource for people. They needed to be allowed to collect that wood. And that was okay. that was okay for generations and for people to go into the woods and just collect mostly debris and dead wood, what was lying around there. And because those forests were the property of feudal lords, and there was that agreement in between those lords and the people living in the villages that it was okay to collect the wood. And then suddenly something weird happened, and those forests were changed by, rather than calling them feudal property or under the dominance of a lord, they were turned into private property. And that switch, which is something merely on the symbolic level, was discussed there in that regional parliament with Karl Marx sitting in the back benches. And what happened there was, and that enraged him, really. He was a person that could get angry pretty easily and pretty extremely. So those people collecting their woods were changed from mere wood collectors to thieves. And that was wrong in his eyes. And that was the first point where Karl Marx was affected with the intricacies of economy and the appropriation, the wrongful appropriation of resources by people that were just allowed to do so because some parliament told them it was okay. That was the, in my eyes, that moment, watching theft and watching people being turned into thieves, that started Karl Marx's interest in economy.
It seems to be a quite emotional moment, after all.
I'd say so, yes. I'd say so. That was emotional for him.
And this whole context of Marx, you also mentioned Hannah Arendt.
Yes.
And, that she has criticized Marx. Why is that so?
Well, she Hannah Arendt criticized Karl Marx in quite some parts, and she had a certain dislike for one trait of his thought that is evident in that part already. She once said, I think that was in a different context, that she'd call Karl Marx a revolutionary but not a philosopher, which is not the worst thing, I'd say, but still that says something about her relationship to Karl Marx's philosophy. And she criticized in a letter to Karl Jaspers and in her thought diary, she criticized those articles on the theft of wood that Marx wrote as not taking into account the individuality of the need of those people that collected the wood or that wanted to own the forest and the resource as such. That sounds a little abstract, but still there's that point that Hannah Arendt is right. Marx wasn't interested in that particular single individual human being. He was interested in the proletariat or mankind as such, and he wasn't interested in that wood or what wood that was. And Hannah Arendt says that might have been plastic as well. And she's right about that. Marx wasn't interested in the individual things, but more in the abstract and historical differences, as with that changing of the forests from one symbolic state to the other, from feudal property to private property. And that, you know, made her say that Karl Marx is not a philosopher, but more a revolutionary. Those texts, just by the way, they weren't philosophical. They were merely journalistic. But still, she's right about that. Marx wasn't interested in that one, I don't know, mother of four children needing to collect the wood to make bread for her kids. That didn't interest Karl Marx. But Hannah Arendt had a pretty fine feeling for people giving up the individuals for the greater good, which was always abstract and in her eyes with a tendency to be totalitarian.
So they just had a different concept of human beings and individuality?
Well, I'd say so. Hannah Arendt was always interested in the individual, in that individual person, whereas Marx was interested in mankind. And Arendt once said that giving up thinking or caring for the singular person and turning towards working for the greater good of mankind is always something or might even be something like human sacrifice, she said. Giving up the needs of singular individual person is something like sacrificing it to the greater good of the betterment of mankind. And that with that pathos, actually, as well. And I think she's right about that. And I like that thinking because it's about the one and single person that I look towards in my study of theft as well, because theft and stealing is always following your own particular and oftentimes peculiar desire and your wanting, that one thing you want. And thieves aren't interested in mankind as such. They just follow their longings. And if they want that candy bar or that apple or that pear and whatever has been stolen so often in literature, that's what they want. And they don't care about mankind.
Yeah, very good. Let's switch to another topic, heliocentrism.
Yeah.
That is to say, the model that the Earth turns around the sun instead of the other way around.
Yeah.
And in this context, Hans Blumenberg claims Copernicus to be a thief because of his new theory. But what exactly does Copernicus, according to Blumenberg, steal with it and from whom?
Yeah, well, that is a pretty complicated question, because the Copernican revolution is a topic, I think, not even yet properly understood what happened there. Because just saying, you know, from Copernicus on, the Earth revolves around the sun and not the sun around the Earth, that just doesn't explain what happened there. And one has to go back one step to see what the cosmology of Ptolemaic times looked like. And that was the Earth in the center as the most material, even the lowest planet, but encased in those crystalline spheres with the moon and the planets and the stars and the angels. And those spheres, one has to understand them really as spheres of crystal revolving around the Earth in an intricate and spiritual dance, encasing it and caring for it and sheltering it as well. And that was the notion before Copernicus. And he said, you know, that's just not right. It can't happen like this. It can't be, because calculating how the sphere with Uranus or with Neptune revolves is such a difficult mathematical formula that we just can't uphold this. And he said, let's change it. If we change what revolves around what, we get very, very much easier formula to calculate that. And he says, well, then if you say the Earth revolves around the sun, and that just makes things easier. And in all this, something happened, because for the Earth revolving around the sun, one has to do away with that thought of the spheres, with those crystalline spheres. They have to be shattered and taken out. And then what happens is that space becomes indefinite and eternal, because not having those spheres that are always measurable, and we have indefinite and infinite space. And that, taking into account infinity in physical matters, is something like a property that once was only God's. Only God was infinite and eternal before that, and now suddenly physical space is. And Hans Blumenberg notes that in his marvelous and very thick book, and Die Legitimität der Neuzeit, the legitimacy of, I don't know, modern age. I don't even know if it's translated into English yet. He says that thing that's stealing from God the notion of infinity or eternity was what kickstarted secularism, or the modern conception of enlightenment as well. And maybe it wasn't Copernicus. He himself was actually pretty conservative, but Nicolaus Cusanus, later on popularizing and radicalizing Copernicus' ideas, he did that. He said, now we are the ones being able to think infinity in physical terms. And that took something very important away from God, just like Copernicus stole the fire from the God of the sun. There was Blumenberg makes that a parallel notion, something almost the same. The modern age and the Enlightenment starting with a little theft of something symbolic, but of the utmost importance, which was infinity.
I see. Amazing. Now, Mr. Geller, we've already taken a lot of your time, but maybe one last question.
Of course.
In his book, Moses and Monotheism,
yeah,
Sigmund Freud argues that the biblical Moses was murdered. However, you claim that this is false and that instead the whole story is all about theft.
Yeah.
Could you shortly present Freud's argument and then explain your alternative explanation and how it differs from Freud?
Yeah, that is also a large question pertaining pretty much one of the largest chapters and the most difficult chapters of my book. And the thing is, Freud claims that Moses was murdered by the Hebrews, and thus there was a patricide fitting into his theory of the Oedipal killing of the father. But the thing is, nowhere in the Jewish Bible is it even implied that Moses was killed by the Hebrews. There is no trace of that, which doesn't bother Freud. He had that hermeneutics of looking into the depths of texts, deeply below the surface structure of texts, and found things there that, even if they are not true as such, make a lot of sense as his argument. Now, I don't know whether Moses was killed or died of old age or something, but the thing is, on the surface of the text, of the books of Moses, there are traces to be found what happened there, and there is even an explanation why Moses had to die at that point. And that is in the context of him taking away something from God and being punished for that. There was that one moment when the Hebrews were walking through the desert and they were all very, very thirsty and almost dying from thirst. And Moses got a tip from God, and that if he hit his staff upon a certain rock, there would be water flowing out of that rock. Moses did that, and a well sprung, and the Hebrews had to drink again. And God saved his people at that moment, as he did very, very often. Now, it is said in the fifth book of Moses that Moses had to die because he didn't give God the honor for that. He took away God's honor in that gift. And that is a very important context for my whole work that always works, that is always written on the background of Marcel Mauss and his wonderful essay on the gift. And because the one giving a gift is always in a more powerful position than the one receiving a gift. Gifts give you power. And even God has to be careful whether he's being given the honor and thus the authority of gift giving. So Moses died because he took away something from God or didn't, you know, really reciprocate him on that gift. But the interesting thing is there's a lot of more real stealing in the Jewish Bible. For example, Rachel is stealing the household gods of her father. She's just taking that away, not killing her father, but stealing from him. That is something pretty different from Sigmund Freud. It's also a crime of foundation, as I say, because Rachel is founding her own family by that theft, making a difference in between her father and herself, but still sticking to the tradition of her father in stealing his household gods. And there's a lot of more thefts going on in the older books of the Bible. Even Eve taking that apple in paradise in God's garden is more or less stealing from his tree. And there's way more. The Hebrews, when they had their exodus leaving Egypt, they took the gold of the Egyptians. And Joseph had that theft of the silver cup very, very intricately organized. Even there's a lot of stealing in the Bible, and very little killing of the father. And that happens on the surface of the text, which Sigmund Freud wasn't that much interested in, because he had that archaeological view into the depths of meaning and into the unconscious of texts and peoples. And I tried to read the surface. And there's a lot of telling about stealing in the Bible, very little of killing the father. So I think giving that perspective to biblical texts of stealing and theft, that gives it a different meaning. Same thing, actually, but with less violence, less killing or threatening the father, less bloodshed, and more cunning thievery and intelligent appropriation of what one desires.
Okay, Mr. Gerlach, that sounds like a great book of yours. I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you.
And I really enjoyed it, so take care.
Thank you, you too. Bye-bye.